The Tom Woods Show, episode 1678.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, by now you've probably noticed that news about the virus is almost always fact-free hysteria these days. So you need my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. Go pick it up at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Paul Gottfried is back with us today, and not a moment too soon. We have got the utter pusillanimity of the official conservative movement on shocking display before us, so that is the time in particular to talk to Paul Gottfried, but in particular when he has a brand new book, and he has a new collection called The Vanishing Tradition, Perspectives on American Conservatism, of which he is the editor. He's also the editor of Chronicles Magazine, which is a magazine that was important to my intellectual development and career, so we'll say a word about that as well. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
All right, let's get stuck into this, as the British say. You have in this book, I was just saying it's your most optimistic book title in a long time because it's called The Vanishing Tradition, not The Vanished Tradition, The Dead Tradition. There's still a little something struggling along there. And it's a great collection from the kind of people you won't hear from on Fox News, on right-wing radio. These people don't exist. You don't exist. It's it's bizarre and hideous. And this is really, I think, a very timely collection. You couldn't have known just how perfect the timing would be, because now we are getting to observe in real time the very phenomenon you're describing, which is that the so-called right wing in America is a bunch of pathetic losers who are 97% on the left side of things that matter, and the other 3%, they are racing to apologize for and make sure everybody knows they're not like you and me, even though you and I don't exist. The whole thing is the most bizarre charade.
So, no, I mean,
give us your, in other words, at this point, you've seen it all, right? I mean, you've dealt with these people, like the neocon stuff, face-to-face, up front, and sometimes been stabbed in the back, too, not always face-to-face, for a long time, and now you're observing their response to the current situation, which is not just the George Floyd protests and riots, but also their response to the lockdowns and how they viewed people who protested them and so on. There's a lot to be said. Is it possible that you're more contemptuous now of organized conservatism than you were the last time you and I spoke, probably 6 months ago?
Believe it or not, I have become more contemptuous. I really didn't think they would call for pulling down Confederate monuments and even going along with the defacing or desecration of Confederate graves in national cemeteries as quickly as they have, or that all of them would be on board with renaming Army bases that bear the name of obscure Confederate commanders. They are actually more contemptible than even I had imagined up until perhaps a few months or even a few weeks ago.
What I can't understand is, why does history seem to go this way, at least in recent history? Why is it that the left proceeds relentlessly and the right, if it even is identifiable as a right, exists for the purpose of surrendering? It doesn't seem like the world has to be that way, and yet it is. Why?
Yeah, I am working now for Cornell University on a book on anti-fascism, in which I argue, among other things, that the left pretty much takes over after the Second World War and would have taken over much more completely had it not been for the Cold War and the struggle against the Soviet Union, which required the United States and Western countries to appear to be on the side of Christianity against godless communism. Also, the left for a very long time was taken up with the task of defending the communist or minimizing the danger from the communists while attacking dangerous right-wing regimes like Franco's Spain. And what this really does, in my opinion, is postpone the eventual victory of the totally lunatic left. Another thing which the Cold War does is it leaves the communists in charge, or the Soviets in charge of communist parties. And the Soviets were ruthless militarist and ran a totalitarian regime, but they were also socially conservative. They did not like homosexuals. They hated the cultural Marxist, whom they tried to remove from communist parties. They fought long wars against them. They opposed abstract expressionism in art and 12-tone music and so forth. So they really were social cultural conservatives. With the disappearance of communism as a force, or Soviet communism as a force, the lunatics took over the left, and they were able to, they were occupying all kinds of vital institutions, including universities, the growing media, which, you know, in an age of technological advancement became much more important than they were, let's say, in 1950 or 1960, when newspapers became the primary vehicle for distributing current events. So the left were able to occupy all vital institutions by the time the Cold War ends. And the Cold War does not end, at least in the West. In Eastern Europe, of course, is a separate matter, but at least in Western countries, the Cold War does not end with the victory of the right. It ends with the victory of the lunatic left. Because the Soviets, as ruthless and as evil as they were culturally conservative, or relatively speaking, whereas Western countries under American influence had already drifted into things like gay rights and feminism and other expressions of the cultural left. So I'm not at all surprised that this has happened. I think it was perhaps in the works already, you know, with the defeat of fascism and the creation of a kind of liberal democratic or social democratic alternative. The cultural left, I think, was sort of kept under control for a long time by the Cold War and by Soviet communists, but seems to have become unleashed with the end of the Cold War.
Let's jump to one of the specific topics in the book. It's covered by our friend Keith Preston. Guy fascinates me. Mm-hmm. I don't fully understand him, but he fascinates me. And he's got an essay on Emmy Bradford and on that whole controversy between him and Bill Bennett. And, you know, I have a very young audience that some of them were born after Reagan, if you can believe that. Mm-hmm. So this is ancient history for them. Can you tell that story? First, just give us without any editorial comment, what were the facts of the matter? What was going on? Who were these people? And then let's get into the nefariousness of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to demonize the neoconservatives, since I'm supposed to be speaking as a scholar in this interview, but they do become the dominant force in the American conservative movement by the 1980s. And by then, they've sort of marched through conservative foundations, taken them over, put their people in charge. And they were viewed as reliable anti-communists, which they were, but they were anti-communists of the left. They represented that part of the left which lost to the communists. And they had sort of made their peace with corporate capitalism and with the democratic welfare state, you know, since the 1940s or 1950s. And most of them were of Eastern European Jewish descent. They were very strongly Zionistic, and they were centered in New York. However, most of the people who land up working for them are Irish Catholics, like Bill Bennett. Bill Bennett, of course, is the one who becomes the director of the National Endowment for the Humanities once they dump Bradford. Emmy Bradford was the choice, the first choice of President Reagan after he was elected to head the National Endowment for the Humanities. And the important thing to know about the NEH is that it had lots and lots of patronage money, which is exactly what the neocons wanted. I think, as in the case of the neoconservative war against me at Catholic University a few years later, I think what this war was about was less ideology than gaining control of something. In my case, it was gaining a graduate professorship at Catholic University, which you could give to a fellow named Steve Schlesinger, who was a neocon, reliable neocon. And in the case of Bradford, they did not want some Southern rube, you know, running the NEH when they could put one of their own guys in charge.
Northern rube.
Right, a northern rube. an Irish democratic, you know, machine politician is the one they wanted to put in charge. Right. So they made a war on Bradford. You know, they dragged out stuff that he had attacked Abraham Lincoln in a footnote to a book, by the way. One has to search through the book to find this. Then they got Eric Foner, I think at the time was still a Stalinist, to write a newspaper column attacking Bradford as a racist. Foner was very, very well rewarded. He received hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants from Bennett after the cons took over the NEH. They were very, very generous people in rewarding their supporters with government money. So they were able to push out Mel Bradford. Now the strange thing about the marginalization of Bradford was that Ed Follner was then the head of the Heritage Foundation, and Bill Buckley, who I suppose was the de facto head of Conservatism Incorporated at the time, both go to visit President Reagan in the beginning of his first term in 1981, in January, I think it was January of 1981 or February, beginning of February of 1981, and warn him against giving the directorship to Mel Bradford on the grounds that Mel Bradford would be a disgrace in that office. He did not bring the kind of character or dignity that the office required. And Reagan had second thoughts, and then he gave this to Bill Bennett, who came with the recommendation of both William Buckley and Ed Follner. And also, we might add, the recommendation of Commentary Magazine. National Review, I think, pretended to be neutral in this matter. But there's no question that Buckley himself was involved. As I suggested before, I think the real reason that they were going after him, the serious reason, was not cultural or sociological, although these factors may have entered into the decision to destroy Mill, who was a friend of mine at the time. I think it was a question of acquiring the patronage, which was millions of dollars that control of the NEH would bring with it.
That episode, it's like a microcosm of everything we've endured since then.
Mm-hmm.
Except in our day, Bradford wouldn't have been nominated to start with. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
Right.
But otherwise, the demonization, and not only the demonization, but the demonization of somebody who is in every way their superior. I mean, Bradford versus Bill Bennett? I mean, I think I once looked at Bill Bennett's PhD dissertation. Did you ever see this?
Yes, I have. It's terrible.
It is a joke. And that's the best they could come up with. I mean, but the thing is, but when you have the influence they have, that's all they have to come up with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They can come up with a nobody like this. So
there may
so
have been
this,
other people asked to do this, but they probably were gainfully employed elsewhere. Whereas Bennett was just waiting for this opportunity, and was not a tenured professor of English at Princeton, or did not hold the kind of prestigious position that would have caused someone to think twice about taking the directorship of the NEH. So he did fit the job description as far as they were concerned.
You have a chapter in here called "The Tory Right and the American Conservative Movement: Parallel Universes."
Mm-hmm.
Again, these are all written by other people. And it just makes me wonder, kind of along the lines of my initial question, about conservatism such as it is, as it exists around the world, and whether it always falls into this American pattern. I think it was Sam Francis had a book called Beautiful Losers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't exactly remember what he meant by that, but it couldn't have been complimentary. And he was talking about American conservatism. Mm-hmm. Are they losers everywhere, I guess is my question.
No, I don't think this is the case everywhere in Europe. I mean, clearly Eastern Europe, which lived under the thumb of the Soviet Union, has remained relatively conservative. And a country like Hungary is led by a conservative nationalist. In the case of Western Europe, I think what you have are movements like our conservative movement, which are essentially centrist movements that represent corporate capitalism and are sort of moderately left on social issues. And these are the Christian Democrats in Germany, the Républicains in France, and their counterparts in Italy and England and elsewhere. But then you also have movements of the populist right, which like the Front National in France, the AfD in Germany is not really on the populist right. It's simply the right wing of the Christian Democrats who have defected from Merkel. But you do get right wing movements in Europe. I mean, you even had at one time neo-fascist in Italy. So what you get there is something like the conservative movement in the United States, which is in power. It's the right center. Or the Freiheitliche Partei Österreichs is a right-wing party. But then you also get the Volkspartei, which is basically like the neoconservatives or conservative Republicans in the United States. So you do get independent rights. I think what's happened in the United States is that there was a kind of right-wing populist movement that was galvanized by Trump, who I think in every way since then has betrayed it. And then you have the conservatives who are basically the never-Trumpers or the people who did go along with Trump, hoping to push him toward a kind of conservative movement, big business, socially liberal position. But I think you do have something like the populist right existing in Western Europe, but they're not the people in power. They're the ones who are kept out of power by alliances between the left and the so-called conservative center.
I'm curious about the subject of the American founding and all this because of the chapter you have on that, the Trump, neoconservatives, and the misrepresentation of the American founding. This is a problem with the Straussians, where they view the American founding as kind of an ongoing project. So they'll think of America or Reconstruction as America's unfinished revolution and so on and on. So they speak like leftists completely, that what we have in society is the working out of the inner dynamic of the original idea, which was universal equality. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, that's what they want to talk about. I think the argument that the Jaffaites make is that the argument now has been shifted to how we define the question of equality. And, you know, we have to go on worshiping Lincoln, Reconstruction, Thaddeus Stevens is now a hero, and so forth. But we have to understand that the notion of equality is tied to virtue. So West Coast Straussians, I think, would quibble a bit with the gay rights advocates right now. The East Coast Straussians are sort of less committed to this notion that America is, you know, is based on human rights or something like this. What they would argue is that the United States was founded as a Lockean republic, but they have their own interpretation of Locke, which I think David Gordon, among others, has disputed. But when it comes down to where the East Coast Straussians stand politically, they're almost all never-Trumpers. I mean, they sort of stand with the Bush Republicans, and they tend to be absolutely fanatical Zionist. I mean, Israel is a sort of big issue, even for the ones who are not Jews.
Well, when it comes to the American founding, it turns out Bradford is actually one of the best people to read.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was very, very good and very precise on this, and not given to it drove him crazy the types of language and rhetorical flourishes and I don't know, kind of a weird utopianism, just weird stuff that would come out of Harry Jaffa and some of his followers. Who's a good antidote to, you know, the misunderstood American founding or deliberately obscured American founding? I mean, who would you recommend people read?
Yeah, one person I would definitely begin by reading, although he is quirky, I know him personally, and will not ever quote Mel Bradford, although he sounds very much like him, is Barry Shane. Barry did a very good book on the myth of American individualism, arguing that America is founded as a Calvinist republic and showing how pervasive Calvinist theology was at the time of the founding of America. He also did a collection of readings from early America on the Declaration of Independence, which I, looking at the first Congresses at the time of the creation of the American Republic, and he shows, among other things, that there was a serious dispute about whether to accept Jefferson's language about all men being created equal. Some of the people present at the Continental Congress disagreed violently with the idea. Others, like John Dickinson, were ready to walk out. Dickinson, of course, was a monarchist who thought that, you know, we should simply petition the king nicely and leave all this discussion of human rights, you know, out of our petition. And Barry shows how pervasive the sentiment was. And then for a long time, the all men created equal rhetoric was sort of, you know, pretty much ignored until it's revived by abolitionists. So to say that this is the continuing American political tradition is an exaggeration, to say the least. But Shane is a very valuable corrective, particularly his book on the Declaration of Independence, which I heartily recommend to your audience.
You start off the book with an essay by Jack Kerouac, whom I've gotten to know just by reading his essays online,
right. Mm-hmm.
on the general subject of American exceptionalism mm-hmm. and conservatism. And I remember, I didn't read it, and I've kind of sworn to myself after what happened with one of my books that I would never, ever speak ill of a book I had not read.
Mm-hmm.
However, I can't imagine Mitt Romney's book about, I forget what it was called, like No Apologies, just, you know, some kind of tough guy book, you know, about American exceptionalism. I can't imagine that's worth anything. But yet that kind of dominates American conservatives. It really is like an outlook that's supposed to make losers feel good about themselves because we don't have to apologize to anybody because we're Americans. It's so vulgar. It's just so low and vulgar.
And hypocritical. I mean, I think that's even more interesting. Could you imagine how we would react if Germans said we are an exceptional people? What about the Russians? Are they allowed to say we're an exceptional people? Israelis are allowed to do this because, you know, the Zionists fund the Khan Inc., but only Americans and Israelis presumably will be allowed to say that we are exceptional. I agree, it is vulgar. It is ridiculous. Yet it has become an acid test for who is a conservative on Fox News. I hear Sean Hannity every night, you know, saying that so-and-so is not a conservative because he doesn't believe in American exceptionalism.
Yeah, it's just not the way. I mean, if you read Felix Morley, some of these guys from the 50s, the way they spoke about what it meant to be an American, it wasn't this. It wasn't this vulgar stuff. But well, and that's a good segue into foreign policy because you have, I mean, this collection really hits it all.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of what would constitute a conservative foreign policy? And here's the problem that a lot of us run into. It's arguing all day about who's really a conservative and who isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And libertarians have the same thing. Are you a real libertarian or not? And I don't know if the left does because I don't pay any attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is, you know, you could, I don't know, could you make a case both ways that a conservative could favor at least if not a neocon foreign policy, you know, a robust military with a realist foreign policy that does require some intervention from time to time. I mean, couldn't you make a conservative case for that?
Yes, I think you could make a conservative case for that. And that would be my own position, everything being equal. The problem now is that the people who call for a robust military typically want a neoconservative foreign policy, whereas the people on the other side to whom, you know, to whom I lean viscerally, the Ron Paul crowd, don't want to have very much of any kind of, you know, military presence anywhere. You know, right now, faute de mieux, as the French would say, I lean toward the Ron Paul camp because I do not trust the people doing this. I also have another problem with, you know, the people who want a strong military presence. And I was made aware of these reservations listening to a man named Colonel or General Keane. I don't remember what his rank is, but he appeared on Martha McCallum and was explaining why the most important issue for us is standing up for human rights in Hong Kong and having a strong military presence in the China Sea. Now, this man is saying this, you know, while our cities are being burnt down by Black Lives Matter and Antifa. I would think that what's happening in Minneapolis or Washington or New York City would be more important than what's going on in Hong Kong. But for these people, it's not. It's because, you know, they're getting money from the arms industry, as one of our contributors points out. They have a very deep emotional and ideological commitment to military intervention. So if these people are the ones who want the robust military, you know, my answer is no thanks.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. How does Southern conservatism fit into this story that you're telling?
Yeah, I think the Southern conservatives are the first to get kicked out. About the same time as I was kicked out. I was kicked out with Clyde Wilson and a whole bunch of Bradford and others. Although I'm not a Southerner, I'm not a Southerner. I am sympathetic to these people. I certainly am sympathetic to their right to be heard as conservatives. But I think much of the intellectual and aesthetic force of the conservative movement, whatever aesthetic force was there, came from Southern conservatives, from the Southern agrarians, people like that. And when the neoconservatives take over, these people just get kicked out. Part of it, I think, is sociological. They just didn't like Southern conservatives. They thought they were anti-Semites as well as racist. So that, you know, they work relentlessly to get rid of them, to marginalize these people. And then I think the attacks on Mel Bradford required going after Southern conservatives in the end, right? I mean, he's an example of a Southern conservative. So that, you know, and then once they went after Bradford for the NEH directorship, they kept coming after him because neocons, as I point out in my article, don't stop. You know, after they, you know, go after you in one thing, as I can testify to, they will come after you in other situations as well, because you've become an evil person from their, you know, from their standpoint. So, you know, they went after Bradford for other positions as well, pointing out that he did not like Abraham Lincoln, that he was, you know, a fan of Robert E. Lee or whatever. So I think the effect of the campaign against Bradford spilled over, you know, into how the conservative movement dealt with other Southern conservatives.
You're the editor of Chronicles magazine now, which, by the way, you may not know, is where my very first article ever was published in 1993.
I remember.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I'm a memorable person. So what I want to know is, you know, that's been fighting against this for a long time. How that fits into this story and what you're trying to do over at Chronicles?
Well, if you remember back in the early 1990s, there was an alliance between paleoconservatives and paleolibertarians when Murray Rothbard was still alive. And I was part of that alliance, needless to say. It came apart later. I have never, by the way, blamed the paleolibertarians. I think the problem was probably on the other side at the time.
I think so, too.
Yeah, we would agree. I think most of my editorial staff would also agree. you know, that alliance came apart. But I would like to revive it. In fact, as I tell people, I am open to all alliances on the right, excluding, you know, crazy people like neo-Nazis or white nationalists, noisy white nationalists. But, you know, I think it's very important for all traditional elements on the right to pull together. I'm also convinced that the game that the conservative movement has been playing for years of triangulating may be over. You can't triangulate anymore when the left has gone totally crazy.
Now, explain what triangulating is.
Well, okay, this is something I write my essays on. Conservatism Incorporated, for a long time, has acted out a strategy by which it tries to build alliances with the moderate left, while at the same time excluding and anathematizing those on its right. So what you do is, you know, as you sort of position yourself in the middle, which is where they want to be, particularly on social issues, you attack everyone on your right. You attack people who don't like, you first attack people who didn't like Martin Luther King or didn't support the Voting Rights Act or something like, or the Immigration Act. Then it goes on, you attack people who are too adamant in opposing gay marriage or people who are too obstinate in their prejudice against the transgendered. I mean, you just sort of keep moving left without giving up on certain positions. And those are the positions that your sponsors want you to take, like supporting the Israeli right, having a robust military presence everywhere that you can, and supporting an alliance between large corporations and government, right? These are things the conservative movement cares about because this is where its money is coming from. But at the same time, you try to be friendly to people on the left who are friendly to you. So you invite them onto Fox News. You pay for leftists, for friendly leftists. You have dialogues with them. And at the same time, periodically, you move toward the left. Like, you know, one day you're against flying the Confederate flag in Columbia, South Carolina at the State House. Then later on, you say, well, you know, it's time to get rid of Robert E. Lee's statues. And then finally you decide, you know, we have to get rid of these Confederate names on Army bases in the South. So what you do is you try to slowly move in the direction of the left, but then sort of position yourself where the left was the day before yesterday or just yesterday. And at the same time, excluding everyone who doesn't on the right who doesn't move in the same direction with you. So this is exactly how the conservative movement has been thriving. It's been getting money. If you're lucky enough, you get to write a column for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Atlantic. It's a close alliance between the Atlantic and National Review. You know, they share writers and so forth. Well, what has happened now is the left has gone totally crazy. I mean, they're pulling down statues, Columbus, Rob. So what is the conservative movement's response? Steve Hilton, I hear him on The Next Revolution. We should meet the blacks halfway. And of course, I'm not sure even all the blacks support this. We should take down all the Confederate monuments. We should rename the army bases, but we should favor Trump's populist revolution, whatever's left of it, I don't know. Then you pick up National Review yesterday. They want you to take everything down. You know, you're not allowed to have even have a Confederate flag, you know, in a NASCAR, you know, and then we can talk with the moderate left. Well, you do, the left won't let you do this because the left is moving too frenetically leftward. And at some point, even the Fox News junkies, the half-wits who go along with the movement, whom I've compared to Communist Party members, in the 1930s, even these people are going to have to wonder, where the hell are we going? You know, how much more are we going to give up? So I think that in the end, the conservative triangulators will be overtaken by the frenetic radicalization of the left, which they cannot possibly keep up with.
Yeah, I think parts of the left can't even keep up with it. I think parts of the left are genuinely surprised at what's going on. I don't know if you saw Matt Taibbi's piece. I mean, he's insightful sometimes. And the other day, he was saying the left has just lost its mind completely. And he was just listing example after example. This is not how normal people behave. So I think even – and of course, Joe Biden is too senile to know what's going on. But he must be – he must have no idea what he's supposed to do. And he must be thanking God for that virus, because if he had to be – giving stump speeches every day with people screaming at him about police brutality, and he's never going to support any meaning behind whatever they mean by defund the police. He's never going to support that. Good for him. It would be really, really miserable, I would say, right now. In other words, Trump can deal with – Trump gets energy from hecklers, whereas Biden would be totally thrown off.
No, I agree. And once they put him into a nursing home, if he gets elected – we'll have the good fortune of living under Stacey Abrams or Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, you know. That would really be interesting, because then we'd have one of the crazies at the top of the government, right? And
now you know what it's like being a Catholic under Pope Francis.
Right.
All right. Well, listen, the book is The Vanishing Tradition, Perspectives on American Conservatism. Is this published by Cornell?
Yes.
That's tremendous. Absolutely tremendous. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1678, where I'll also link to Chronicles magazine, which is a magazine that I like very much. And as I say, I wrote my first article for it. I wrote a number of pieces for it over the years. And I'm really glad you're at the helm, because I know good things will happen. Well, thanks a lot, Paul.
And thank you for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for today. Tomorrow, coming back to the program after a long absence, is Dale Brown of the Detroit Threat Management Center. I've had more feedback on that episode, I don't know if I can say, than any one I've ever done, but it's darn close what he's been able to do in the areas that he's had some influence over in Detroit. It's just astonishing. So we're going to talk to him about what works, what doesn't. So make sure you subscribe, tomwoods.com/apple, so you don't miss any of these episodes, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.